Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. Florida United Businesses Association. FUBA is a statewide trade association representing Florida businesses. FUBA also publishes The Advisor, a pocket-sized guide to the Florida legislature. More at fuba.org. And from the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 900,000 union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. WFSU FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Members of the House and Senate are taking the first steps to negotiate the differences in their gambling plans.
I don't want to unrealistically raise anybody's expectations on this committee. These are difficult issues, and the lift remains heavy.
Also tonight, we'll hear the latest on legislative efforts to automatically restore voting rights to former Florida inmates.
We want them to become good citizens, to pay their taxes, to contribute to society, and many of them are. They're out, they have jobs, they're raising families, and yet they have no say over who they can elect.
We'll also hear about some possible changes in Florida's guardianship laws and an apology that's some 70 years in the making. I'm Tom Flanagan. It's day two of week seven in the 2017 Florida legislative session, and this is Capitol Report. The Florida House and Senate have taken the very first steps towards working out a gambling deal this legislative session. Regan McCarthy has more.
Members of the House and Senate met Monday for the first conference meeting of the session. Typically, conferencing is something used to work out differences in the two chambers' budget proposals. And House Budget Chairman Carlos Trujillo says he and his counterparts in the Senate are preparing to enter into that process.
Obviously, for a bill to become a law, and the budget is a bill just like anything else, it has to be identical in both chambers and ultimately go to the governor for his signature. Our House bill is very different from the Senate bill. Both bills have passed their respective chambers. Now in conferences, we'll renegotiate which programs we're going to keep, which programs we're going to eliminate, and for how much money we're going to allocate to each program.
But Monday's talks didn't include Trujillo. That's because the conference focused on gambling, not the budget. Other than that, the story is largely the same.
Good afternoon. I see we now have a quorum. So I'll call to order the meeting of the Gaming Conference Committee.
The two chambers' gambling proposals have passed on their floors, but the plans they contain are markedly different. St. Cloud Republican Representative Mike LaRosa, who's pushing the House bill, summed up the differences quickly when the House took up the Senate bill, then passed what's called a strike-all amendment to replace that bill with language from the House proposal.
The Senate bill expands gaming. The amendment does not. In fact, it does the opposite.
Some of the main differences between the bills relate to paramutual gambling. The Senate wants to give eight paramutuals that passed local referendums the right to operate slot machines. The House stands staunchly against that. The Senate also allows paramutuals to decouple. That means operating card games without facing a requirement to hold a certain number of live races. The House plan would block that from happening for the next two decades. But despite those differences, during Monday's conference, Miami Republican Representative Jose Diaz sounded hopeful.
We are very eager to begin the negotiation process. Obviously, there are a lot of folks here in this room. There are a lot of interests when it comes to gaming, and I believe that we have the right person at the helm. Senator Galvano has already brought this in for a landing once. I can't imagine working with a better partner in this. The House is excited to be here.
Representative Diaz will serve as vice chair of the Joint Conference Committee on Gaming. Bradenton Republican Senator Bill Galvano will serve as chair. Galvano says he's enthusiastic, but also cautious.
I don't want to unrealistically raise anybody's expectations on this committee. These are difficult issues, and the lift remains heavy.
But Galvano says if lawmakers want to maintain authority over gambling decisions in the state, they need to act soon.
Given what has occurred over the last several years, but especially recently with the judicial branch and the decisions that are coming out and the complexity and ambiguity of the issues that we're dealing with, inaction is not an option. We have to act.
Galvano says he's committed to do what he can to help a gaming measure pass this session. Any agreement will also require negotiation and agreement with the Seminole Tribe of Florida, which operates several casinos in the state. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
A panel of Florida lawmakers began a discussion this week to consider automatically restoring the civil rights of ex-felons who committed nonviolent crimes. And we get that story from Sasha Cordner.
Democratic Senators Perry Thurston of Fort Lauderdale and Daryl Rousson of St. Petersburg are both carrying bills making it easier for ex-felons to have their civil rights restored to allow holding certain state licenses or voting. Thurston says the current process is flawed. Today, ex-offenders have to go before Governor Rick Scott and the Florida Cabinet as the Executive Clemency Board and ask that their rights be restored.
It really shouldn't be subjective to who's in power in the governor's office.
And Rousson says the goal is simple.
If we want people to be able to fully reintegrate themselves into society, after they've served their sentence, paid their debt, done their time, it's vital that we do things that allow them to participate and express themselves in government and the governing process as a part of being in community.
Both bills provide exceptions for automatic restoration, such as people convicted of rape or murder. Ocala Republican Senator Dennis Baxley says while he agrees with the creation of a more timely process for restoring civil rights, he's against automatic restoration.
That part of the process needs to be more approachable and more responsive. And those are the kinds of things I would look for in dealing with that kind of issue.
Baxley says the other thing you'd like to look into is the restoration of Second Amendment rights.
How can you protect your family and others from harm? How can you do things like go hunting with your grandson and spend some time teaching him character and the proper use for a firearm instead of for violence towards people? And if you never have those restored.
Meanwhile, Fleming Island Republican Senator Rob Bradley says he not only worries about the bill's constitutionality, he believes this is an issue for the voters to decide.
Having them revisit this matter at some point in time, and then leave it to the legislature to do the specifics.
Lakewood Democratic Senator Jeff Clemens has carried similar bills for years to no avail, and he says it's time for Florida to do something.
We are an outlier in the state of Florida. Estimated 1.5 million people here can't vote, for instance, because of some mistake they made 20 or 30 years ago. That represents somewhere about 30% of the people in the United States who can't vote. Because of felony history.
While members of the Senate Criminal Justice Committee did not vote on the bills Monday, panel chairman Randolph Bracey, an Ocoee Democrat, says they may do something next year.
I would like in the near future to have a bill with everyone's input that could move through the legislature. So this is the beginning of a conversation about this.
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Florida patients may be able to vape or munch on medical marijuana products, but they almost certainly won't be allowed to blaze up joints or take bong hits, that under a compromise plan being worked on by House and Senate leaders. Lawmakers are trying to reach consensus on a proposal to implement a constitutional amendment overwhelmingly approved by more than 70% of voters last fall, which legalized medical marijuana for patients with a broad swath of conditions. A House committee today approved one approach to the amendment, and a Senate committee was poised to approve a different one later in the day. It would make Florida one of the largest marijuana markets in the country when fully implemented. But neither side has any intention of allowing the marijuana products to be smoked, despite repeated demands from numerous patients, caregivers, and others who insisted that smoking provides some individuals with the best type of treatment. Still to come on Capitol Report, lawmakers want to change how the state oversees people who are incapable of handling their own affairs. The bill would make it easier for a guardian to get a divorce for an incapacitated person, and that has some lawmakers worried.
Should they be allowed to move for divorce when neither individual has asked for it? I would suggest to you the answer to that question should be an absolute no.
After years of being filed, a bill further compensating a surviving child of abuse has passed the Florida Senate for the first time.
This will not bring back Nubia Barahona, but it will go a long way towards ensuring that something like this doesn't happen again.
Descendants of the Groveland Four are getting an apology for how they were treated by a 1940s justice system that was anything but just.
And today, I feel free. I feel like I can talk about it.
And a college media class hopes to raise awareness and penalties when it comes to distracted driving.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org.
A slate of changes to Florida's guardianship law now headed to the governor's desk. Kate Payne reports the updates legislators want are meant to protect some of the state's most vulnerable residents.
Florida's guardianship laws outline how someone is deemed legally incapable of handling their own affairs. Ultimately, finances and end-of-life issues can all be overseen by a guardian. Here's St. Petersburg Democrat Ben Diamond explaining how Floridians get there.
The first thing that happens is the court appoints an examining committee of three people to go out and examine the alleged incapacitated person.
The board then submits a report outlining the situation and what they think should be done. But a recent case found if board members don't present the report in person, it's considered hearsay, which means it can't count as evidence. Diamond wants to fix that.
That is creating a lot of confusion and burden on our guardianship courts.
But lawmakers say the courts would grind to a halt if board members had to attend every hearing.
If every time a guardianship is established, the three individuals have to appear in court, it'll cost a fortune, and basically paid for by the ward.
Naples Republican Kathleen Pasadomo is sponsoring the bill in the Senate.
So what we wanted to do is only require attendance by the three individuals if there's a problem.
And her plan creates a process for the courts to use the reports as evidence. The bill also changes how an incapacitated person can file for divorce.
This is the only place in the law where an individual cannot file for dissolution of marriage, or the guardian can't file for dissolution of marriage without the consent of the other party.
Representative Joe Geller, a Dania Beach Democrat, worries abusers could trap their partners.
What spouse that's abusing their incapacitated spouse is ever going to agree?
But when Orlando Republican Representative Eric Eisnagel looks at the bill, he sees a chance for guardians to take advantage of people.
In Florida, should a paid guardian who has a financial interest in the relationship, should they be allowed to move for divorce when neither individual has asked for it? I would suggest to you the answer to that question should be an absolute no.
But Boynton Beach Democratic Representative Lori Berman says the guardian doesn't have the final say. They simply start the court's process, which includes
appointing an independent attorney, receiving evidence of independent medical psychological and social evaluations, personally meeting with the incapacitating person, All of those procedures are in the bill.
When Riverview Republican Ross Spano isn't in the Florida House, he's running a law practice. And he knows the bill won't end abuse entirely, but he says the benefits outweigh the risks.
And I would please ask you humbly to respect the opinions of those of us who practice in this area and believe us when we tell you that it is necessary and that the interests of the ward will, in fact, be protected.
The new divorce rule spurred a lot of debate in the House, but the Senate voted the bill forward unanimously Tuesday with no complaints. It now heads to the governor's desk. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
The Florida Senate unanimously passed a bill approving the remaining payment of $3.75 million to the surviving victim of a child abuse case. Joseph Zabios Roik reports.
Victor Barahona will receive the money as part of a $5 million settlement with the Department of Children and Families. Barahona and his twin sister Nubia suffered extreme abuse at the hands of their adoptive parents. She later lost her life. The bill's sponsor, Miami Republican Senator Anitera Flores, viewed it as a way for the state to make amends and bring closure.
This small amount will go to do the right thing in two ways. Number one, to try and bring some closure to this issue. But number two, it's a way for the state to say, we're sorry, we're wrong.
Flores said the high-profile case led to changes in how DCF handles the care of foster children. The agency was found to be negligent for ignoring signs of abuse, and it triggered a legislative overhaul of the state's child welfare system. A companion bill is now headed to the House floor. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Joseph Zabios Roy.
State leaders are attempting to make amends for the Groveland Four, a group of black men wrongfully convicted of raping a white woman in the 1940s. Nick Evans reports it's one of two major apologies lawmakers are planning this year.
The fourth floor rotunda is buzzing as nearly a dozen lawmakers gather to apologize to the family members of the Groveland Four. Here's House sponsor Bobby DeBose, a Democrat from Fort Lauderdale.
I want to first start out by saying, you know, with this injustice, we, the state of Florida, we were wrong. The injustice these men and their families encountered are hard to really just truly put into words.
In 1949, Norma Padgett accused Ernest Thomas, Charles Greenlee, Samuel Shepard, and Walter Irvin of rape. Padgett was a 17-year-old white woman. Her alleged assailants were all black. Officers apprehended three of the four, but Thomas fled. A posse of more than 1,000 armed men later shot and killed him. A mob also lashed out against the local African-American community in Groveland, burning the Shepard family home to the ground. To extract confessions, officers beat Greenlee, Shepard, and Irvin. Prosecutors never submitted those forced confessions at trial. Still, all white juries convicted each one. Thurgood Marshall, then an attorney with the NAACP, got the convictions overturned at the U.S. Supreme Court. After that ruling, Sheriff Willis McCall shot Irvin and Shepard while transporting them to a different facility. Shepard died. McCall claimed self-defense, and again, an all-white jury agreed, clearing him of any wrongdoing. McCall was also present when the posse killed Thomas after he fled Groveland.
The memories can't be erased. The pain they've endured can't be fixed. But today, we have an opportunity to provide closure to these families in the form of an apology.
A number of Groveland Four family members are on hand for the occasion. Carol Greenlee is Charles Greenlee's daughter.
And today, I feel free. I feel like I can talk about it. I feel like I can sit down with my nieces and nephews and brothers and tell the story that my father, at my age, 40, held back the tears to tell me.
Jeanette Shepard is Samuel Shepard's niece.
Our home was the one that they raided and burnt down and sent my grandma and granddad running from Groveland, the area. So I never really got a chance to meet my granddad. I just meet him through this. I meet Sam through this.
And it's not the first time this session lawmakers have held this kind of gathering. Earlier this month, St. Petersburg Democratic Senator Daryl Roussan spoke in favor of an official apology for the children abused and killed at the Dozier School for Boys.
And today is the next step for this legislature to honor their memory and to declare with honesty, conviction, and clarity that these types of atrocities and tragedies should never occur again.
Like the Groveland Four, lawmakers have been pushing the legislature to recognize what happened at Dozier for years. Official apologies are relatively rare. But this year, a number of influential Republicans, including House Speaker Richard Corcoran, have signed on, giving the proposals enough support to gain traction. The measures for Dozier and Groveland are resolutions, meaning they don't need the governor's signature. But in the Groveland case, Governor Rick Scott may still have a role to play. The resolution urges the governor and cabinet to review the cases and grant full pardons. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Organizers of this weekend's Tallahassee March for Science are stressing unity and bipartisanship. While marchers worldwide are galvanized by a climate change-denying White House, Florida protesters are at ground zero for sea level rise. And we get that story from Jim Ash.
This Saturday's Tallahassee March for Science and 400 others around the globe are taking place on Earth Day. The first Earth Day was inspired by the 1969 Santa Barbara oil spill off the coast of California. As marchers gather for Earth Day nearly half a century later, the environmental threat is more global and the science behind it is under attack.
At the core of it, science is evidence. So we want to use this evidence when we make decisions in the policies that we put in place so that the public interest is protected.
That's organizer Susan Glickman, a lobbyist for the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. March director Alexa Barquette acknowledges the event is being inspired by the Trump election, but she prefers to look on the bright side.
If there is a silver lining to, you know, things turning out the way they have with the election and everything, that would be it. It really has turned me into an activist for the first time in my life, and I'm really enjoying that role and meeting a lot of great people along the way.
Marchers will begin gathering at 11 a.m. at Anita Favors Thompson Plaza across the street from Cascades Park. After about an hour, they'll march to the steps of the old Capitol on Monroe Street. Barquette says guest speakers will emphasize the nonpartisan nature of scientific inquiry.
Science doesn't really belong to one side or the other, and it's not really for the Democrats or the Republicans to side with or without. It's more something that everyone should be concerned with.
Florida State University distinguished research professor and noted physicist Dr. Harrison Prosper will address the crowd, and so will Gulf Specimen Marine Lab founder Dr. Jack Rudlow. Dr. Jeff Chanton, a Tallahassee geochemist and environmentalist, hopes to reassure the crowd that science is not the enemy.
People see more and more automation. They see technology increasingly important in their lives. People are losing jobs to robots, and they just don't know what they're going to do. And I think they're afraid that, you know, perhaps science is behind all of this.
One of the biggest scientific debates in Tallahassee is over hydraulic fracturing. Thousands of protesters have flooded the Capitol in recent years, mostly to fight an industry-sponsored attempt to create a regulatory program. This year, protesters want legislative leaders to rescue a statewide fracking ban that stalled in both chambers. Southern Alliance's Glickman says it's a good example of how science influences policy.
So there has been more discussion at a scientific level about Florida's karst geology and what that would mean in that one particular technique to drill.
National studies have linked fracking to contaminated drinking water and even minor earthquakes. But industry experts say their own studies show the practice would be perfectly safe in Florida. Expect the debate to continue at Saturday's Tallahassee March for Science. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, Tallahassee Community College professor Reggie Grant seems more like a combination circus ringmaster and whirling dervish as he counsels his mass media class on this Tuesday morning in early April.
A couple of your colleagues mentioned that it would be good to have a debrief so everyone knows what everyone else is doing.
The class numbers nearly 20 students. One of them is putting the finishing touches on an online video.
There's the visual distraction, there's the manual distraction of your hands, and there's the cognitive distraction.
The student working on the video, Brittany DeFriend, says the entire project is a multimedia campaign to discourage distracted driving, especially texting while driving.
This is a big issue that's rising because so many people are doing it and not everyone realizes that you're doing it. It's so easy to be distracted while you're driving. So just to remind people to be cautious about that, I think is really important.
But beyond changing behavior, DeFriend says the idea is to change Florida law.
As, you know, awareness is brought to it and as more people fight for the laws to be, harsher on distracted driving, I think more people will be more prone to think twice before texting and driving or driving distracted.
Once again, the Florida legislature is contemplating a bill that would make distracted driving a primary offense, meaning law enforcers would need no other reason to pull over an offender. There will be a rally at Tallahassee Community College in support of the measure on April 20th, and that's what student Jack Hook is working on.
Going through and like filtering through and trying to like find the right image for an online like post so we can try to get people to come out and like support this event.
Hook's project partner, Cody Seller, says this requires a lot of thought and coordination to maximize the audience impact.
We will find like a statistic on distracted driving. We have to find a picture that will match the fact. And at the same time, it's kind of hard because you have to get the right resolution and distortion, stuff like that.
Amelia Petrowski is in charge of the project's Facebook presence.
People live on social media. Anytime that you're bored or anything like that, the first thing that you do is you grab your phone and you look on social media. So obviously if it's there, then it's going to reach everybody.
Still, Professor Reggie Grant believes it's real life examples of what distracted driving can cause that has the most visceral impact.
A 20-year-old, I believe it was, killed 12 or 13 people in Texas. He admitted to the fact that he was texting and driving. I mean, just 12 people gone. That's ridiculous.
At the beginning, Grant wasn't sure just how his students would respond to the project.
I was just really, really, really happy that the students have taken to this. And it's, we've had our challenges. This has definitely not been, one of those assignments that everything has been easy. But, with those challenges, I think that, there's some really amazing stuff that's going on.
Among those things, a commitment that the Distracted Driving Bill's House sponsors, Emily Slosberg of Delray Beach and Richard Stark of Weston, both Democrats, will attend the on-campus rally on the 20th. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Sarah Mueller, Kate Payne, and Joseph Zabias Roy. Technical assistance for Capitol Report provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And please join us each weeknight at this time throughout the 2017 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: a grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman & Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. Florida United Businesses Association. FUBA is a statewide trade association representing Florida businesses. FUBA also publishes The Advisor, a pocket-sized guide to the Florida legislature. More at fuba.org. And from the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 900,000 union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.